So my talk today is on the effects of the global financial crisis on Australian financial markets. One effect potentially is that there are not so many attendees at conferences like this anymore, probably. It's partly because there's not so many people working in financial markets as there used to be. So what I'm going to do is focus today on the way the global financial crisis has affected Australian financial markets. So up front, the positive point to emphasise is that the effect of the crisis on Australian financial markets has been considerably less than in many other countries. That said, many markets in Australia have been and continue to be significantly affected. So in some instances, this has warranted a policy response to address the particular market dysfunction, and I'll talk about that as we get to it. But before describing some of these effects and the policy responses, I'll first give a potted summary of the global financial crisis, at least from my perspective, to give some context to the developments in Australian financial markets. And we put out a financial stability review last Thursday, which provides considerably more detailed discussion of the evolution of the crisis. And as the FSR points out, the crisis can basically be viewed through the prism of risk. So, as has been pointed out for a number of years, risk premia were excessively low for a number of years leading up to the middle of 2007. There are many explanations that have been advanced for why this was so. Some attribute it to the prolonged period of economic stability in a number of major countries dating back to the early 90s, which caused investors to become overly optimistic about the future. Some attribute it to the low interest rates that prevailed for much of the earlier part of this decade, which caused investors to search for yield in new and less well-understood products. I'd have to say that I find the search for yield explanation somewhat incomplete. It focuses primarily on the average return of the investment, along with the investment's diversification benefit. But the part which is incomplete is why the risk element of the risk-return trade-off that everyone's talked was downplayed or misassessed. So I'd attribute a very large role in the financial crisis to the wholesale failure of risk assessment and risk management. In that regard, a recent speech by a colleague of mine at the Bank of England, Andy Haldane, highlighted the statement by David Viniar, who was, and is, I think, still the CFO of Goldman Sachs. And he said this in August 2007. So what Viniar said was, "We are seeing things that were 25 standard deviation moves several days in a row." So I repeat, that was in August 2007, in the very early days of the crisis. I'd hazard a guess that we've seen quite a few more 25 standard deviation moves in the subsequent 18 months. And in fact, the month of October 2008, following the collapse of Lehman Brothers, basically was a whole month of 25 standard deviation moves. It was, hopefully, the collapse of Lehman Brothers, that is, a once-in-a-lifetime event. And as Andy Haldane points out in his speech, for those of you who might have forgotten their statistics, a 25 standard deviation event actually is already a once-in-a-lifetime event. As it turns out, it's a once-in-the-lifetime-of-the-universe event. So to say that you've had two in a row, either the life of the universe has got considerably longer, or it's probably the case that the models used to assess and manage risk that allow you to come up with such statements were in many cases just plain wrong. This applies to models used by investors, issuers, and regulators. In some cases, the models may have been close to right, but their results were overridden by other considerations, including, amongst other things, a short-term profit motive and asymmetric compensation for risk-taking. So this misassessment or mismanagement of risk led to a large number of investment decisions being taken which have obviously subsequently proved to be extremely costly. Another misassessment that occurred in the financial sector was the assumption that off-balance sheet vehicles, which were investing in these misvalued products, were really off the balance sheet. The disintermediation that had occurred prior to 2007 to the so-called shadow banking system had turned out to be a veil, not unlike the curtain behind which the Wizard of Oz operated. Now, for those of you who may not be aware, the Wizard of Oz is actually a financial allegory. Written about the gold standard back around the turn of the 20th century, about Williams Jennings Bryan. So once the veil was removed, just like the Wizard of Oz, financial institutions found themselves dealing with large amounts of exposure to underperforming assets that they had not anticipated. As these exposures have materialised, we have seen an enormous increase in risk aversion. So just as risk premia had been too low for a number of years prior to 2007, we now see an overshooting in the other direction. In addition, trust in the financial system has been significantly compromised, both between the public and the financial sector, and between financial institutions within the financial sector. So counterparty risk aversion, that is the willingness to deal with other financial entities, is at elevated levels currently, and with the Lehman's collapse exacerbating an already fragile environment. So while elements of those problems were present in Australia, they were and have been present to a significantly lesser extent than in many other countries. So one significant factor contributing to their absence is that the core of the financial system in Australia has remained highly profitable, from lending to households and businesses. So, for example, the larger Australian banks have been able to deliver pre-tax rates of return on equity of well over 20% for many years. Hence, there was no need for these institutions to engage in any search for yield outside their traditional realm of lending to businesses and households. As the Australian financial institutions had minimal exposure to the securities that have beset other financial institutions and had solid balance sheets, as we documented in last week's FSR, there has been considerably less concern in this country about counterparty risk. Nevertheless, the dislocation in global financial markets over the past 2 years has translated in varying degrees to local markets. So in the remainder of this talk, I will discuss some of those channels. So the most obvious one, which everyone is well and truly aware of, has been the decline in the local share market. So what I've got here is a graph which takes the peak in various share markets and tracks their performance through time. So these are the largest declines we've seen in the history of the Australian stock market. And the orange one, obviously, is the episode we're currently in. So from its peak in November 2007 to the lows reached earlier this month, the local market has declined by 54%, which, as you can see there, it's only been one larger than that. This fall compares to the peak-to-trough decline of 57% in the US, 61% in Europe, and 60% in Japan. So on that metric, the impact on our market, on our stock market, has been similar to other countries. And as this shows, it's obviously been one of the largest on record. So while these large falls have been comparable, the Australian market had generally outperformed the markets, other markets in earlier years, so that today, the US and European stock markets had fallen back to levels last seen in the mid-1990s. So if you think about it, if you invested in the European stock market in the middle of 1990, you're back to where you were then. In our case, the Australian market has returned to the level of mid-2003. So not so much of a wealth destruction there. The Japanese market's recent lows, however, were the levels last seen back in 1984. In recent weeks, though, the market has risen, along with other global share markets, in net terms at least, so that for the March quarter to date, the local market is only down by a few percent, significantly smaller than the 19% fall we saw in the December quarter. So one reason is the performance of the share prices of the financial sector. So reflecting their comparative health, the decline in the share price of commercial banks in Australia has been considerably less than those recorded in the US and the UK. As I show here, you can see that the decline in the share price here has been basically similar to that for Canada, whose banking system has basically the same structure and the same degree of profitability as the Australian banking system. The other aspect of the stock market is that it's experienced considerable volatility. So what I've got here is year by year just the numerical count of the number of times the share market has either fallen or risen by 3% in a day. So as this graph shows, the number of days in 2008 where the market went up or down by more than 3% was unprecedented. 22 of the 40 large movements in 2008 actually occurred in the fourth quarter of 2008. And it's interesting to note that despite the market falling a long way in net terms, most of the largest daily movements are actually rises rather than falls. Now, in talking about the stock market first, that's actually not right from a timeline perspective, because it actually took a number of months in the second half of 2007 for the equity market to catch up to the credit markets, who had started to go awry around the middle of 2007. So one of the obvious initial manifestations of the crisis was increased spreads in short-term money markets beginning in around August 2007. So the spread I'm looking at here is the difference between bank borrowing costs at a particular maturity and the expected policy rate at the same horizon. These increased spreads were in large part a function of the increase in counterparty risk aversion that I spoke about earlier. Banks were more inclined to hold on to their cash rather than lend it to others. So in terms of policy response, so this is the crisis beginning here, we responded to that increase in precautionary demand for cash by financial institutions by increasing the supply of cash, which is what I've measured here by exchange settlement or ES balances. If we had not done so, there would have been upward pressure on the cash rate, which is the red line here, which is the interest rate on overnight borrowing in the interbank market, driving it above the target that the Reserve Bank Board sets in their monetary policy decision. So as the demand for cash has fluctuated throughout this period, the Reserve Bank has adjusted the ES balances to ensure that the cash rate has remained at its targeted level, which by and large it has done. This graph also shows that these pressures tend to increase around the quarter end, where banks have a preference to hold more cash and undertake less lending on their books for their when they balance their books at the end of the quarter. The initial rise in spreads in Australia was considerably less than that in the US, UK and Europe, where that risk aversion rose considerably further. Indeed, almost throughout this period, the spreads in the Australian market have been lower than other markets. However, spreads clearly peaked again around the time of the Lehman's episode, when the spread between the 90-day bank bill rate and the expected cash rate rose as high as 100 basis points. Turnover in the money market in October, as it was the case in all global markets, was significantly curtailed. So, in order to address the pressure on term money market spreads, the Reserve Bank increased the maturity of its daily open market operations. So this was aimed at enhancing liquidity in the term money market. So our system of open market operations has always had the capacity to adjust the terms of our operations very quickly, and we availed ourselves of this flexibility throughout the period. So towards the end of last year, when those pressures were at their height, we began to offer terms of 6 months and 1 year on a regular basis. For those who are interested, who don't realise it's a fairly arcane topic, these issues are discussed in more detail in a speech I gave last October. As I noted then, to allow us greater capacity to address the pressure on term money markets, we began to offer term deposits, which are these orange things here, which is effectively an exchange settlement balance at a long maturity of either 1 or 2 weeks. But recently, as is clear from this graph and the following graph, there have been a number of signs of improvement in conditions in money markets. Spreads have fallen considerably and are now well below the average of the crisis period. They've not fallen back to their pre-crisis levels, although I'm not sure that's necessarily an appropriate benchmark, as it could be argued that spreads were excessively compressed in that period. Furthermore, as this shows, as the demand for cash has abated, we've been able to reduce the supply of ES balances back to around $2.5 to $3 billion. We're seeing demand for long maturities in our daily open market operations decline significantly, and on the number of days when we've offered those longer terms, we haven't seen any demand at all. Notwithstanding this, the bank will continue to offer these longer terms on a regular basis going forward. But also as a result of this, we've been able to reduce term deposits outstanding to a very low level, about $300 million today, with the intention at this stage of not offering them again for some time unless circumstances warrant otherwise. So if we move out beyond the maturity spectrum of the short-term money market, there has been a significant impact of the global financial crisis on the bond market. So as the crisis has unfolded, there has been a marked process of re-intermediation, going back to the banking sector. Corporates who had previously been able to borrow directly in financial markets found these markets were no longer accessible and turned to the banks for funding. This process saw a surge in intermediated business credit in Australia in the last part of 2007. And then through 2008, there's been almost very little Australian bond issuance. Though, but in the last few weeks, again, there have been some signs of life. In global bond markets, there's been a marked surge in non-financial bond issuance since the beginning of this year. And in corporate issuance in the US so far this year is actually around or even higher than pre-crisis levels in terms of volumes, if not in terms of spread. And one interesting development in the local market is in the last couple of weeks, there have been two corporate offerings aimed directly at the retail market. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. But for the bond market in Australia, most of what we're talking about is this market, which is the bonds issued by the financial sector. And again, reflecting the developments in global credit markets from August 2007, bond issuance was clearly affected. Initially, it took the form of a widening in spreads at issuance. So this is the beginning of the kick-up in spreads here in August 2007. then at various times in the months following, it was difficult to issue at any price. This wasn't just something the Australian institutions found, but other global financial institutions. So the Australian banks took their opportunities to fund themselves as they came up. They adopted a conservative strategy of getting as far ahead on their funding programs as possible. So what I've got here shows you the bank's bond issuance month by month. So this is the beginning of the crisis back here. You see the issuance start to drop off. The red bars are the share of bonds issued offshore. The darkish blue bars are the share of bonds issued domestically. And then obviously, as I'll get to shortly, once guaranteed bond issuance started to kick in, the yellow bars are guaranteed issuance offshore. The light blue bars are guaranteed issuance onshore. But as is evident here, in January and February 2008, so we're 6 months into the crisis by this point, there was sizable issuance by the banks in offshore markets. Indeed, in January 2008,
this bar here,
issuance by Australian banks was a significant share of total issuance globally by anyone, US and other global institutions in the US market. Also, as is evident here, funding markets basically shut down completely following the collapse of Lehman Brothers. That's here. All global financial markets were dissipated by this event, and not surprisingly, term debt markets were about the most affected. The destruction of confidence between counterparties in the financial system was very large. Investors were extremely unwilling to take on any exposure to a financial institution at any maturity. In many money markets around the world, maturity shortened dramatically, so only the overnight market was barely functioning, and a number of central banks became effectively the intermediator of last resort. So in response to that drying up of term funding markets, a number of countries, beginning with Ireland, began announcing government guarantees to support debt issuance by their banks. In a global financial market where institutions are competing for funds, the provision of a guarantee to one group meant that it was extremely difficult for others to compete effectively for funds. Hence, in the wake of the dislocation induced by Lehman's, many countries, including Australia, moved to guarantee bank debt issuance. So soon after the introduction of the guarantee, Australian banks were able to once again access term debt markets. And you can see in those months following, they've been accessing that in size. To date, the banks have raised $81 billion under the guarantee scheme. There has, however, as is clear in those last four bars, been little investor appetite for unguaranteed debt, despite other indications of an improvement in credit markets. It is a little surprising that investors do not have an interest in unguaranteed paper, I think, and are not keen to see part of that 70 basis point fee that the banks pay to the government for the guarantee ending up in their own pockets instead. As a result of their ability to issue under the guarantee scheme, the Australian banks are well advanced on their funding needs for this year. And their funding needs have all been further addressed by the rapid growth in deposits that we've seen in recent months. So the combination of increased term funding and deposit growth has actually seen a decline in the share of bank funding accessed from the short-term markets. So while term funding markets are functioning better and money markets are functioning better, and there have been some recent sign of life in the corporate bond market, the same can't be said of the securitised market. As is well known to basically everyone these days, securitisation has been at the heart of the global financial crisis since its inception. While the problems in the securitisation process in the US, many of which relate to the mismanagement and misassessment of risk that I discussed earlier, while they weren't present in the Australian market, the local market has been equally dislocated. Prior to the crisis, securitisation accounted for around 25% of housing lending in Australia. However, as I described in an earlier speech and my colleague Tony Richards discussed in a talk on housing last week, the process of securitisation in Australia was greatly different to that in the US. In Australia, the institution originating the loans that comprised the securitisation maintained a number of linkages to the loans, typically including a direct financial stake as well as a substantial reputational link. So if you, a Commonwealth Bank may write a loan which ends up in a securitised product, everyone still knows the loan's a Commonwealth loan. Moreover, lending standards in Australia did not change materially. The data indicate that the loans that were securitised by banks were not materially different in quality from those that were not. For the banking sector, securitisation was primarily an alternative funding source that was accessed when it was cost effective to do so, and provided them with a more diversified funding base. Obviously, for the non-banking lending sector, securitisation was the primary funding source, and as their market has continued to be dislocated, that part of the market has continued to be particularly affected. So this graph shows the issuance securitised residential mortgage-backed securities, issuance of that since this, over the last few years, and you can see that since the second half of 2007, issuance has been minimal. One reason why that has been so has been the sizable overhang of supply in the secondary market. So prior to the crisis, so this issuance back here, as you can see, a substantial chunk of that, which is the green bits, were issued offshore. They were, a lot of those securities were bought by securitised investment vehicles, or SIVs, which are also now a well-known acronym. The demise of the SIVs has seen both a marked reduction in demand, because they're no longer there to buy these securities, but has also seen them sell the RMBS back into the local market, into the Australian market, as those SIVs have been forced to liquidate their whole portfolio. So as a result, spreads in the secondary market for RMBS are very wide, and far too wide to make new issuance cost effective. So to address this problem, the government, the Australian government, through the Australian Office of Financial Management, has undertaken a program of purchasing new RMBS issues. And as you can see, to date, they've purchased around $3 billion, but basically that's been the extent of the issuance in the market in recent months. And the RFM has indicated they have a further $5 billion to be purchased in the coming months. So that market has been particularly dislocated. At the shorter end of the asset-backed market, the asset-backed commercial paper market has also been substantially affected. So what this graph shows here is the decline in the stock outstanding of asset-backed commercial paper over since around the beginning of 2008, late 2007. So the first development which occurred was that the share outstanding in the onshore market actually rose significantly, again as assets which had previously been funded offshore had to be bought back onshore. And then subsequently, as investor appetite for ABCP has diminished domestically too, the stock of paper outstanding has declined significantly. The cost of issuing the paper has risen, and the average maturity of this paper has also shortened up considerably. So in response to the dislocation in those two asset-backed markets, the Reserve Bank widened the pool of collateral that is eligible in our open market operation. So currently, most forms of highly rated asset-backed paper are now eligible collateral for our open market operations. So if you take together the increased money market spreads, the increased spreads on longer-term issuance, and the dislocation in securitised markets, we've seen a rise in the cost of banks for funding their lending. For a few years prior to the crisis, much of the bank's funding tended to move, cost of the bank's funding tended to move broadly in line with the cash rate set by the Reserve Bank Board. However, with the rise in spreads that has occurred, this relationship is currently nowhere near as strong. This has then contributed to the divergence between movements in the cash rate and lending rates that we've seen over the last couple of years. Notwithstanding this, as we noted in the most recent statement on monetary policy, the pass-through of the reduction in the cash rate since last September to housing interest rates has been more complete than almost in any other developed country. This means that this important channel of the monetary transmission process has not been impaired, in stark contrast to a number of other countries, most notably the US. So the relative strength of Australia's financial institutions and Australian financial markets more generally has ensured that this has occurred. So let me now shift gears and talk about some of the effects of the crisis on the foreign exchange market. Now, at least a colleague of mine gave my speech for me a few weeks ago on this topic, so I won't talk about it too much here. But the most obvious impact of the crisis has obviously been on the depreciation of the Australian dollar. But in addition to that, a notable development has been the marked increase in volatility in the foreign exchange market, which is what I'm showing here. So what this graph shows is the peak-to-trough movement every day in the foreign exchange market and average it over the course of the month. So this observation here means that on average the currency is moving in a 1.5 cent range during the course of the day, either up or down. So prior to the crisis, a 0.5 cent move used to be considered on the larger side. Now that's basically, we haven't had one of them for a while. It shows that this is the range against the US dollar, obviously being well above average throughout the crisis period. And the volatility was particularly marked, again, in the month of October 2008, most notably on the evening of the 8th of October, the Australian evening, when the Australian dollar depreciated 9% against the US dollar and 11% against the yen in 6 hours of trading on that night, during which I did not sleep a lot. A number of the large movements in the Australian dollar have also taken place in the last hours of trading in New York. During those times, there have been extraordinarily large movements in many financial prices in both directions. So what we show here is the correlation between the Australian dollar and the S&P 500 in the US in real time. And just smooth it out a bit. But what you can see here is that correlation has been particularly high at various times over the last few months. And at various times, if you look at the correlation in the last 2 hours of New York trading, the correlation between the Aussie dollar and the S&P 500 was basically one. So to some extent, that reflects the fact that some of the investors regard the Australian dollar as a good proxy for global financial market sentiment. So reflecting very poor liquidity in the foreign exchange market on particular occasions throughout the crisis, the bank has stepped in to enhance liquidity in the market to ensure that the price adjustments were as smooth as possible. Finally, let's talk briefly about the foreign exchange swap market, which again is a market which doesn't normally get a lot of attention, but it's also been dysfunctional at times. So in particular, for much of the crisis period, there is what is probably best characterised as a global shortage of US dollars outside the US market. Obviously, inside the US market, American banks have as much access to US dollars these days, particularly, as they want. But a recent article in the BIS Quarterly Review, which came out only a couple of weeks ago, nicely describes the source of this shortage. So as that article notes, much of the excess demand for US dollars in the swap market came from European banks to fund their US-denominated, dollar-denominated assets. So they had to keep on trying to fund those positions every day, so that every day what you would see would basically be a scramble for dollars starting at the end of the US trading day. So we're the end of the US trading day. So it would start in our market, continuing out through the Asian market, into the European market, and then the pressures would ease towards the end of into the US day as US banks were able to access those dollars. So with the increase in counterparty risk aversion, American banks, who had lot of access to US dollars, were much less willing to lend to those European banks who were trying to fund their US dollar position, US dollar asset positions. So while the problem originated in Europe, the shortage spilled over to other foreign exchange swap markets, including in this region. So to address this problem, the US Federal Reserve entered into swap agreements with a number of other central banks, including ourselves, to just basically distribute more US dollars around the globe. So the introduction of this facility, and in particular, the move to provide unlimited US dollars at a fixed price in Europe, the UK and Switzerland. So what that basically means is, in Europe, the UK and Switzerland, they hold options for US dollars at a fixed price and will supply whatever the market wants at that price. So that, particularly that introduction of that facility, seems to have contributed to a marked improvement in the swap market. So in Australia, we've seen a marked drop in the demand for this facility. At our two most recent auctions, which we've done over the last couple of months, we received bids of we auctioned $10 billion a pop each time and received bids for under $2 billion. So the total amount outstanding under the program in Australia is currently sitting a bit under $10 billion. So let me wrap up by saying that the disruption in financial markets since the middle of 2007 has had a marked impact on Australian financial markets and the Australian economy, that's clear. I've discussed some of these channels today, but there are a number of others that I've not covered here which were covered in more detail in last week's FSR. So while local markets have been disrupted, the degree of dislocation has, in most cases, been considerably less than in other countries. So that's the positive story. One important reason for this is that the degree of counterparty risk aversion has been considerably less in Australian markets, given that Australian financial institutions had minimal exposure to the securities that have comprise the balance sheets of other financial institutions around the world. Nevertheless, while ever the global financial system remains disrupted, it will continue to undermine the effect of the sizable policy stimulus being provided around the globe at the moment. The restoration of public confidence in the global financial system and the restoration of confidence between financial entities within the system is obviously a very necessary step on the road to global recovery. So let me finish there, and I'm happy to take any questions on financial markets.
You've mentioned the government guarantee and its obvious impact on bond issuance and Australian market. What is does the RBA agree with the federal government's extension of this AAA guarantee to state debt?
Well, I'm going to answer that question directly, but the state government debt market has also obviously been considerably dislocated in the last few months. I didn't talk about it today, but the spreads have widened in that market up until recently. In fact, widened a little more than the spreads on bank government guaranteed bank debt. And turnover in that market had decreased significantly in the last few months. So clearly, that market wasn't functioning very well.
Guys, Stephen Long, just a follow-up question on that. Now that the federal government is guaranteeing state government bonds, will that impact, or how much will it impact on bank fundraisings and the corporate bond market?
That obviously remains to be seen. I mean, as I said, the corporate bond market is actually showing some signs of life.
Will that continue, though?
I think if you ask most asset managers, most asset managers split their bond holdings into different parts, so that the state government bond market is not a straight sub. The corporate bond market is regarded differently in their portfolios from the state government bond market. So they would have an allocation to corporate credit, an allocation to state credit, and an allocation to bank credit. Now, in that regard, one thing which is interesting talking to some asset managers over the last few months, is they, in terms of where they place the government guaranteed bank paper in their portfolio, they still regard it, in terms of the allocation at least, as bank paper. It happens to have a government guarantee now, but it's still bank paper, which is perhaps part of the reason why the spreads are where they are. So it's not necessarily the case that you buy less of one, sorry, you buy more of one and less of the other. And certainly the corporate bond market, I think, certainly functions in a different part of people's portfolios. So, yes, there's obviously ultimately a limited amount of funds to invest, but I don't think these things are necessarily straight substitutes for each other.
Your colleague, Rick Battaglino, said this morning that Australian growth is looking like it will be negative in 2009. Was that his personal view, or is that now the revised outlook from the Reserve Bank?
Well, the last outlook that we published was in the February Statement of Monetary Policy, and we'll provide another one in May, but you'd have to ask my economic colleagues to answer that question rather than... I'm going to answer a question on financial markets and on the macro outlook.
And just following up on your analogy of the Wizard of Oz, When do we get back to Kansas?
I don't know. Well, having driven through Kansas, I'm not sure if I want to go back there, but... as I said right at the end, a precondition for recovery is a restoration of faith in the global financial system. So, as I think Glenn said last week, the elements of the US package which have been put forward thus far contain some elements of hope. Remains to be seen whether it will actually work, but I think basically the US fixing up its financial system is probably a prerequisite for a sustained global recovery. So I don't want to guess as to whether that's going to work. I hope it works. I said your assessment is probably as good as mine as to whether it's likely to work. But I do think that is a prerequisite for getting a sustainable recovery underway globally.
Thanks.
More question?
I just wondered, this morning your colleague Rick Battaglino said that on average banks had fully passed on the fall in the costs of funds to borrowers. Mm. I'm just wondering, would you now expect that average to rise?
Sorry, in their cost of funds?
The cost of funds. They've passed those four costs on average.
Yeah, no, I mean, today that's what our assessment is. That it's a bit hard to get pinned down exactly what their cost of funding is, but that's roughly what our assessment is, yeah. It really depends where spreads going forward. As I mentioned earlier, money market spreads have come in a bit. Term spreads have sort of been going sideways. and deposit, well, you know, deposit rates have been moving around a bit too. So, you know, their funding obviously has those three components. Depends where the price of those three components moves going forward, and I'm not going to try and predict which way spreads are going to go from here, but I've got not much hope in being right in that. You know, hopefully they continue to come in, but as that graph I showed earlier, we've had a few instances where things looked like we're getting better and then they got blown out of the water again. So I'm not going to, I don't think I can make a good forecast on that. Yeah, sorry.
Guy, in terms of the confidence of the financial markets that you say is so important, how important would you say the coordination of stimulus across the world is to that? I mean, we've seen Gordon Brown and Kevin Rudd perhaps pulling back a little bit. It seems like such a huge... Is that as important a prerequisite as a recovery in the American system?
The Americans have provided a reasonable amount of stimulus already. I mean, the effect of that stimulus obviously is going to be significantly enhanced if the banking sector is working properly. Obviously the G20 is talking about, as I don't really want to get into macro issues, I'd rather talk about financial issues. But obviously there has been a fair bit amount of stimulus put in place globally. The G20 is obviously going to talk about that later this week. But as I said, I suppose I would say, for the stimulus to be effective, one of the other things which the G20 is focusing on is the financial system, and the more functioning the financial system is, the more effective the stimulus of any size is going to be. And I think, as I said, our experience here shows that with a functioning financial system, you get a lot more traction, particularly on the monetary policy side, but also on the fiscal policy side. Yeah, Stephen?
How worried are you about the moral hazard in the Geithner plan, the Obama plan? If you look at it, the government is taking on more than 90% of the risk, and any upside gain is shared 50-50 with private sector investors. And in effect, it seems that they are trying to encourage investors to take the assets off the books of the banks, paying perhaps over the odds compared to what they'd be worth in the market if the government wasn't intervening. Doesn't that run a risk of quite serious moral hazard?
I'm not sure it runs a risk of moral hazard. I mean, to some extent, I think moral hazards are going to be a nice thing to be worrying about in about 3 or 4 years, I hope, but not today. So is the plan designed to encourage private sector participation? Yes, it is. I think that's their stated aim, actually, is to encourage private sector participation. Trying to get the price on these things, well, after 2 years, we still don't know what the price on some of these assets are. So, for anyone to be able to really say that either pay too much or too little is going to be difficult, even with the benefit of hindsight, I think. But the plan is designed to encourage private sector participation, and they've clearly stated that as one of the aims they've had in setting
up. And if they pay too much, the government is going to bear most of the downside.
The way it's set up is the government's providing more of a leverage, yes. So if that is indeed what happens, then, But again, I think the other thing to bear in mind, I'm glad I don't have to design a plan like that, but second, given the constraints they're working under. But, also you have to consider what will happen if, the plan doesn't work, which is not necessarily good for government finances in the medium term either.
With the fiscal and monetary policies and the stimulus packages, is there to get the financial markets working better, is there an element of that some of these businesses and corporations should be allowed to fail, looking at the GM, possibly looking at that failing, that can actually clear out the issues that exist at the moment better than the faux propping up of these companies that are going to eventually be paid for by taxpayers?
Someone tried the let's see what happens when a financial institution fails experiment, and I don't think that worked all that well. Did a lot of good for my sleep for a while, but that's a very minor concern. But I just think so. That's been you know, that happened. I'm not saying that was deliberate by any means, but we, you know, a financial institution was let fail. I think a lot of good came out of that. You know, within 48 hours, the package was put in place to support AIG. So, you know, because basically all hell broke loose immediately. I mean, so that's on the obviously on the financial side. I mean, GM's a different beast, obviously, car maker, rather than a financial entity. So, yeah. You know, Chapter 11's been around in the US for a long time. The airline industry's been through it most of the time. They're actually in Chapter 11. I think the question is alternative to what? So, yes, it costs taxpayers money to... it doesn't actually necessarily cost taxpayers money. You know, if you look at the Swedish situation, the taxpayer actually came out in front in that instance, so it doesn't actually have to cost in the medium term. But it's also, you know, if that doesn't work, then there's potentially an even bigger cost to taxpayers' money if the global economy is, or the economy is considerably weaker. So it's, again, it's a question of an alternative to what. But, you know, as I said, Lehman's was a medium to large financial institution, failed. Okay, that happened. I don't think the outcome was particularly great. And you can say, well, that's been tried. You know, the supporting them outcome has been tried a few times too, and that hasn't worked too well either. But, you know, at least I think things have broadly continued to function since then. So, you know, it's a tough call, and to some extent, glad I'm not having to make it.
But isn't the Swedish alternative what they're balking at? Nationalising the banks temporarily? Wouldn't that make a lot more sense than the Geithner plan of effectively propping up the shareholders, helping out the shareholders without actually nationalising and then working out these assets over time?
The Swedish example is often used as a benchmark for this. I mean, one, you're talking Sweden versus the US, which is a different scale difference, order of magnitude scale difference. The Swedish financial system was also a lot more concentrated, so they ended up, I think it was two financial institutions, they ended up nationalising. You're looking at, they're doing stress tests on 19 very large financial institutions in the US at the moment. So, you know, I don't think it maps. You know, there are some interesting lessons from the Swedish financial system. Does it provide the exact template? I'm not so sure. There's, you know, obviously things are different now. And, the Swedish banks were primarily Swedish banks. The US banks you're looking at are not only US banks, they're global banks. So, you know, I think it's untouched. It's a tough problem. But so unfortunately, someone has to do it.
Sorry, Guy. We've seen Macquarie recently, just today, really change its remuneration structure for its executives. I mean, people have generally seen this as a kind of a political type of pressure, but does it have an impact on financial markets when you start seeing a major investment bank like that changing to what appears to be something that's largely a source of political pressure?
No, I think you'll have to ask Macquarie. I'm not going to answer that question.
Well, do you think that the pressures or changes to executive remuneration has an impact on the confidence in financial markets?
I don't get paid an executive remuneration pay package, or you have to ask someone who does, whether it affects their behaviour. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm not going to answer that question.
Not clear cut answer, possibly. What's your opinion about the possibility of international coordination of monetary policies in improving the financial system? Do you see any role for that?
Well, yes. In terms of the Financial Stability Forum, which is just had its membership increase 2 weeks ago, the last couple of weeks, is effectively providing a coordinate. I mean, it's been around since the Asian crisis, actually. And Australia's been a member of it since its inception, since that time. But it's had its scope increased to include basically all the G20 countries now. And it provides a mechanism for sort of coordinating financial policies across countries, which I think will be broadly effective, including, you know, templates for financial regulation and the like. So, you know, I think that is beneficial, and that is something which is actually happening. I mean, in terms of monetary policy, again, I think that's mostly an issue for, you know, each country sets its monetary policy. You know, there are notwithstanding where we are at the moment, there's actually still a fair amount of variation in macro conditions across across countries, which explains why countries have different policy settings, as is the case all the time.
And one more thing, I noticed that you're not talking about trust and faith, which are quite difficult to fathom or understand. So you're entering into the psychological realm of investors. How easy do you think it will be to basically achieve this kind of faith and trust of investors?
I think it'll be hard. I mean, once broken, as in any circumstance, you know, not just in finance, you know, trust in financial institutions, trust in anything, once it's broken, it's hard to restore. It's, mm-hmm. You know. So, you know, if it was easy, we'd have done it about just under 2 years ago. But it isn't easy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that will be a difficult process. But as I said, you know, investor, you know, there are some signs that investor confidence is returning in some places. You know, if you're in the US and you're investing short term and getting paid zero for your investment, you might actually start thinking about earning a positive return again one day, and then, you know, move a little bit further out along the risk spectrum. But that process is, you know, undoubtedly going to be gradual. It's not, you know, the dislocation happened fairly quickly, but I don't see that the restoration of that trust is going to be, you know, that is going to be a prolonged process.